Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do artists work and survive in places where they can be jailed simply for having ideas the government declares subversive? When Chinese architect, writer, sculptor, and filmmaker Ai Weiwei was arrested at the Beijing airport last spring and held for 81 days, he was officially accused of failure to pay sufficient income tax. But Ai's supporters are convinced that his detention had more to do with his open criticism of Chinese government corruption, property ownership, and treatment of migrant workers, among other issues. And his stature within the arts community has brought global attention to the issue of Chinese censorship of dissident artists. Joining us to talk about this are Melissa Chu, director of the Asia Society Museum in New York, and Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center. They're scheduled to deliver a joint TEDx-SMU and Nasher-sponsored lecture tonight at 7 at the Nasher Sculpture Center. It's called China, Artists Behind the Wall. Melissa, Jeremy, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So we'll start with the basic details of the arrest last spring. Ai Weiwei was already seated on a flight to Hong Kong when he was pulled off.
That's what we hear.
Yes.
Yeah. Those were the news reports.
Yes, and taken away to an undisclosed location for quite some time before information about the rest was officially released.
And the Chinese government is talking about giving itself officially the right to detain people for up to 6 months before families are even notified at this point?
That's right. There's discussion of that, and we'll see whether that happens, in fact.
So whether or not the tax charges have any validity, many people suspected that the Chinese government really wanted Ai out of commission, given the perceived risk that something like the Arab Spring could spread in China. What sort of activity gave them the impression that this was possible or likely?
Well, his arrest was, in fact, preceded by the Arab Spring, and Ai had been active for quite a long time as a prominent dissident working both in China and internationally, and as a writer, as a maker of exhibitions, a maker of art. And I think at that moment when there was so much tumult in the Arab world and a number of established orders were falling, I think there was clearly concern that that could happen in China. And so that really did seem to precipitate the arrest. But it was preceded by a long period of activity on Ai Weiwei's part that would have been considered provocative by the Chinese government.
How overtly political is his work? If you came to it with no context, would you automatically see most of what he does as a criticism of the Chinese government?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about Ai Weiwei's art practice is that if you were to really examine his works from the early 1990s, say, they're really not political at all. In fact, they don't refer to political figures. They rarely have a political subtext. This really started to change in 2008. Before that, he had already been blogging since around 2005, 2006. But it was really in 2008 that he became much more of a political activist. And we saw that through his blogs and his tweets. His artwork also started to acquire some political connotations, most directly in the works about the Sichuan earthquake, where he gathered together a number of children's backpacks that were meant to represent those children who had been victims of the Sichuan earthquake and the corruption that caused many of those deaths. So that's one of the interesting things about Ai Weiwei, that for us, for museum professionals and for those who have known him for a long time, we knew that he was always an agent provocateur, but it's really been his political activism through his comments in social media that have drawn both international attention and also the ire of the Chinese government.
And going back to the earthquake, people might say, well, how could you blame a government? But there were issues of infrastructure and there had been poorly built schools that a lot of people blamed for those children's deaths specifically.
That's right. And I think that that was one of the reasons why the Chinese government had concerns over Ai Weiwei's project to publish the names of the victims, especially the school children who had died because the buildings had basically collapsed. And they had collapsed mostly because of the poor construction that was said to have been caused by corrupt officials taking money from the project sites.
2008, of course, was also the year of the Beijing Olympics, and I was commissioned to take part in the design of one of the major arenas. In fact, he was the one who came up with the idea for the Bird's Nest Stadium, which is really spectacular. And before, I guess, it was even complete, he had walked away and said, I wash my hands of this whole thing.
Yeah, and I think that was quite a shock, actually, because in the lead-up to the Olympics, he was really being put forward as a bit of the poster boy for the Beijing Olympics, because he was an internationally acclaimed artist who was working in collaboration with the Swiss architects, Herzog de Meuron, and we were able to see him kind of give some glimpse to China opening up to the world and the Olympics being a part of that process. Then when he very publicly withdrew from the project and called the Olympics a fake smile, which is his way of saying that the Olympics was a project that was covering up many of the other not so nice things going on in China. It was quite controversial. I think a lot of people were really taken aback by that.
Yes, I mean, he always remained positive about the work of Herzog and de Meuron on the Bird's Nest, but I think his opinion expressed in his blog about the Olympics overall, from the opening ceremony to all the sort of theatrics around the event, were remarkably caustic. And Melissa spoke of him as a kind of agent provocateur. And I think that really, when you read his blog in particular, the vehemence with which he expresses himself and the kind of take-no-prisoners attitude he has towards anything he approaches is both, is indicative of remarkable courage on the one hand, but also, a sense of, knowing to strike where it's going to hurt.
Is there any reason to believe that he accepted this commission knowing that he could, at the last minute, when he had the world's biggest megaphone, turn around and use it as an opportunity to criticize?
That's a good question. I honestly don't think that you would, as an artist, take on a project knowing that you were going to withdraw from it. Mm-hmm. I think that he is really credited as having the design for the Bird's Nest, the national stadium for the 2008 Beijing Olympics. I think that it was an amazing project for an artist to work on. And I think that that's really what has drawn so many world-renowned architects and artists back to China. For those who were even overseas Chinese who have gone back, if you looked at the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony, so many of those participants were overseas Chinese who were living in places like New York who had been invited back. So it's you also can't underestimate the initial sense of national pride for a lot of Chinese people for the Beijing Olympics, that it was this real international recognition that China had finally come of age.
And just to give some sense of his attitude, he wrote a blog post about the opening ceremony, which he titled Closing the Opening Ceremony. I think I could read from the blog.
Sure.
He says, "These incompetent tools perverted the Olympic opening ceremony into the archetypal example of bogus traditional rubbish, a blasphemous spirit of liberty, a visual crap pile of phony affection and hypocritical unction. Offensive noise pollution and a monarchical mentality have been revived as a vaudeville variety issue. It was the ultimate rendering of a culture under centralized state power, an encyclopedia of spiritual subjugation. Before we can stand up straight, we are heavily bent over once again. We sacrifice the cheer and goodwill of the entire population in exchange for a worthless fantasy, a soulless political whitewash, and a hopelessly humorless display of puffery and helpless bravado. It was a phony scene of cultural prosperity, one that runs counter to reality.
Certainly a man who pulls no punches.
Absolutely.
I like that word puffery. I don't know which dictionary that came from.
So exactly this moment of where really I think China was showing it to itself to the world with enormous pride in a moment of an extraordinarily important national moment, he takes down.
Ai Weiwei has been called China's first global artist. If assuming that is not hyperbole, what is it about his work that makes it so?
Well, I think a few things, and Melissa can speak much more to this than I, but I'll just say he spent about 12 years in New York, and really his real awareness and of art came from came initially from those years and his exposure in Soho, the East Village. And so he brought back to China both an intense awareness of Chinese culture and Chinese art and art history, but also he very much participated. He exhibited in New York before he returned to China. I think his awareness of what's happening, what was happening in the West, as well as his awareness of the present moment in China, has made him someone who's very comfortable artistically in both worlds.
Yeah, I think Jeremy's point about Ai Weiwei's time spent in New York is an important one because he spent over a decade living in the East Village. He was very close to Allen Ginsberg and many of the leading people that were really part of downtown Manhattan life. And I think from that, he was able to draw on this kind of spirit of individualism, and he bore witness to a number of the Tompkins Square riots in the late 1980s that were part of the gentrification of New York City. And so when he went back to Beijing, he really did stand to influence a whole new generation of artists. And in fact, there was an East Village established in Beijing that carried out, a number of artists carried out quite radical performances. What I would say to Ai Weiwei being perceived as the first real global artist, I think that there are a number of issues that have converged around this consensus, especially consensus in the West, because as we still think in some terms of New York as being the center and London and other places, and in a way, it's decision makers in those places that determine this idea of a global artist. So here is Ai Weiwei. He spent over a decade in New York City, so he's very aware and familiar of Western art history and having seen artworks at the Museum of Modern Art. In fact, he took many photographs of himself in front of Warhol photographs when he was in New York City. He also speaks English. He kind of came of age politically in a way in New York, having seen what was going on around him. So I think when we talk about Ai Weiwei as being a global artist, we have to also be aware that the Chinese government, in a way, made him a global artist. Mm. He is now a household name thanks to his arrest earlier this year.
My guests this hour are Melissa Chu, who is director of the Asia Society Museum in New York, and Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center. They're giving a dual lecture this evening at 7 at the Nasher Sculpture Center called China, Artists Behind the Wall. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get on the line now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center, and Melissa Chu, director of the Asia Society Museum in New York. They'll be giving a joint lecture tonight at 7 at the Nasher Sculpture Center called China, Artists Behind the Wall. It is sponsored by TEDx, SMU, and Nasher. If you would like to join our conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think at KERA. A.org. I want to talk a little bit about Ai Weiwei's background. His father was a very well-known poet, which essentially meant that I spent the very earliest days of his life living in exile.
Yeah. What's different about Ai Weiwei from his peers of a similar generation, he was born in 1957, is that his peers were mostly Red Guards or those who participated in the Cultural Revolution. Ai Weiwei's different in that his father was sent to the countryside to be re-educated and he accompanied him. So he saw the Cultural Revolution from his father's perspective rather than from his peers. When you talk to other artists about their experiences during the Cultural Revolution, what stands in contrast to our assumptions about the Cultural Revolution is that these young artists actually enjoyed the period. That they were given relative freedom, freedoms that they didn't have in the past. They were able to travel all around the country away from their parents. They were sent to the countryside to be re-educated. But their life in small villages is often something that they kind of are quite nostalgic about. So Ai's experience during this period was quite a difficult one. He has said that he saw his father working in public toilets and things like that. That was quite traumatic for him.
How did at least nominal tolerance for the arts play out at the end of the Cultural Revolution, when at least art for its own sake was allowed theoretically to be produced in China?
The Cultural Revolution ended in 1976. And there was a period when artists were starting to adjust to these new freedoms. But when we talk about Chinese contemporary art, we really think of its birth as being in 1979. And Ai Weiwei, interestingly enough, was one of the participants in the very first experimental avant-garde group in 1979 called the Stars or the Xingxing Group, who, remember, this is the same year that Deng Xiaoping declared his open door policy that opened up China to the world, specifically to foreign investment, but that's a longer story. So Ai Weiwei was one of a number of artists who really wanted to show their work. They knew that they couldn't do it in the National Art Museum. So they decided to organize their own exhibition and hang their work on the fence of a park opposite the National Art Museum. So if you think back to this time in China, it was a time when you required a license in order to have an exhibition. So they basically did this exhibition illegally. And Ai Weiwei was very much a part of this movement. So he was really there from the beginning.
And I think it was a fascinating moment because, in effect, these artists were reinventing art for themselves. Much of visual culture, the making of visual culture, had been wiped out, apart from revolutionary posters. There were no books, magazines, visual information that artists thrive upon barely existed. And I think this group of artists found information, shared it among themselves. When they were able to obtain a magazine, they passed around photographs, they copied books out. And I think one of the things that's so exciting about the trajectory of Chinese art over the last several decades is seeing moving from that point to an extraordinarily exciting, proliferating visual culture.
I know that I moved back from New York when his father became ill, but he wouldn't have had to stay necessarily after his father's death. What kept him in China?
It's hard to say. I mean, I would imagine that it was being a part of the burgeoning art scene, mm-hmm. that at the time when he came back, he also became something of a kind of godfather-like figure to many a young artist. Having lived in New York City, you know, he would have had huge cachet in the community and have been able to help artists think in different ways about how to disseminate their work at a very difficult time in China. If we think back to the early 1990s, it was still a period post Tiananmen, post June 4th, where artists were not allowed to show their work at any public museums that were state-run, and there were no real galleries to speak of. I think there was just only one in a five-star hotel in Beijing. So they had to be much more inventive about how to show their work, how to get their message across. One project that he was involved with is a publishing project where a number of artists banded together and published their work. And I recall being in China, visiting the National Art Museum, and being accosted by a group of young artists on the steps, just at the entrance, of them handing me this book. And now it's a very famous book called the Black Flag Book, and there were subsequent other ones published, where you were able to get a glimpse of the Chinese contemporary art scene, which was really otherwise quite underground. It was almost a clandestine activity trying to visit artist studios at this time.
What do galleries look like today in China?
Well, there are an enormous number of art galleries. Beijing, I think, above all, and gallery districts, which are filled with people. I mean, the last time I was in China, one of the things that amazed me was going to the 798 complex and just seeing how many people, and especially young people, were filling the thousands and thousands. They look very good. The galleries look like a lot like Western galleries that we might be familiar with. They might be operated a little differently in some respects from a business standpoint, but I think they've seen a tremendous growth over the last number of years in the kind of techniques of display, installation, and they look terrific.
Do collectors place the same value on works by the best Chinese artists as works by Western artists and people from other parts of the world?
There's a growing group of collectors who are interested in Western art. However, I think the majority of them are primarily focused on collecting Chinese artists. And in fact, the market is alive and well in China. There is a very strong domestic market. And of course, for those who are interested in Chinese contemporary art, Hong Kong has played more and more of an important role, especially in terms of auctions.
My guests are Melissa Chu of the Asia Society Museum in New York and Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center. They're giving a lecture tonight called China Artists Behind the Wall. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. To the extent that Ai Weiwei has been targeted because he is so well known and he has such influence, has he also been somewhat protected by that fame so that he might be jailed for months at a time, but he will not sort of disappear permanently?
I think that's a good point. The speculation around Ai Weiwei's political critique was that he had a fair degree of protection, in that certainly it was his name, his international fame, if you like, but also the fact that his father was a notable poet. So there was always speculation that he had protection at the highest level of government because of that. And so when he was arrested, there was another round of speculation that, in fact, there had been a power shift within the party. But I do think that his release, which was just under the three-month mark, mm-hmm. Was because of a combination of things. I mean, international media pressure and the kinds of protests that were mounted and many other museums across the world, I think, was one element of it.
And President Hu was also about to visit Europe.
I think it was Wen Jiabao.
Excuse me. But what about artists who are not as well known, who may be doing really interesting work that gets under the skin of the government, but may not have international support, may not be as well known even domestically?
I think in general, the Chinese government doesn't care that much about what most artists do. And I think that, you know, when you go to China, you see what artists are doing. There's a tremendous range of visual expression and topics embraced and so forth. I think Ai Weiwei's activities, because they were, he'd found means to disseminate them through his blog, through international exhibitions, he rose to a level where he was noticed. And on the one hand, that protected him, but that also made him a target. And I think in most cases, it's not as much of an issue. I don't think it's deemed the most, art making in China isn't deemed the most dangerous activity.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, say whatever you want as long as no one is listening to you.
Or as long as a small group is listening to you. As long as the, you know, art cognoscenti, as long as a few foreign curators are paying attention, that might not be so bad. But if you have an audience of millions, and if your treatment attracts major attention in international media, that's a different story.
Also, I think if Ai Weiwei had not have been tweeting and blogging, he would not have been arrested. That the Jasmine Revolution and what happened in the Middle East before that just made him much more of a threat than had he just been creating art that was political in nature.
What sort of coverage has there been of all this in state-run media in China?
Very little. Yeah. We know that the Xinhua News Agency was responsible for issuing some of the reports on his arrest. In fact, they were the major source of information for most of the media outside of the country. But there has not, I mean, there is not a great degree of analysis nor commentary in the state-run media in China.
Is it possible to know who makes up his Twitter audience?
Do you know how many followers he has, Melissa?
I don't know.
I'm curious as to whether the bulk of them are domestic or are they?
They're domestic because he tweets in Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was told not to do this anymore, and he's still tweeting on a regular basis. Is that right?
Well, his blog was shut down, mm-hmm. and then after he was released, I think one of the conditions was that he not tweet. But he has started up again.
Not tweet nor talk to the media. And he started up again, and I suspect that it's really about the fact that his co-workers from the studio are still in prison. Mm-hmm. And they have health issues. So I think partly it was driven by his wanting to draw attention to their circumstances.
I suppose it's worth asking, is it reasonable to assume that there were legitimate tax claims by the Chinese government on Ai Weiwei? Neither of you has looked at his statements,
right.
But
one doesn't know. I don't think that information has been released at all. I think the coincidence of his arrest with the Arab Spring and everything else would lead one to doubt there's any legitimacy, but I don't think there's been any real information provided such that one could make a judgment.
Melissa, you mentioned that there's not a great deal of coverage in state-run media. Are people talking about Ai Weiwei within China, do you know?
One of the interesting things about the Ai Weiwei situation was the disparity between the thinking of many in China and contrasting that to outside of China. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in China felt that Ai Weiwei knew what he was getting into. He kind of, that people who live in China know the rules. They know that they're not meant to be criticizing the government. And so there was a strong sense in China that he may have got what he had deserved because he had been for so long a strident, overt critic of the government. So I think that what was surprising to me, at least, was the lack of any response from the artistic community or media. We know that the media is mostly state-controlled. But the online community, through blogs and tweets that the government finds it more difficult to control, was fairly silent on this issue.
And I think that he gored a lot of oxes.
Mm-hmm. That's a great expression right there.
And I think that, just as Melissa said, I think any number of people could have taken offense at things he said. He really spared no one in his criticisms. And I think perhaps that might have played a role as well.
What sort of control or restrictions does the Chinese government place on artists who come in a variety of media from other places to perform or to exhibit their works within China?
You still need a license.
Mm-hmm. Do you sort of sign away certain rights?
License meaning that it needs to be reviewed by the propaganda department in advance of presentation. So there have been occasions, I know, of performances at the Opera House and others where certain things had to be removed, not because they were political, but because they were deemed unsuitable for audiences. Violence or nudity or sex are still out of bounds.
It's certain there can be censorship both of foreign artists and domestic artists, but I think typically in the more public arenas, major exhibitions, performances, and so forth.
What role did Chinese art collectors have to play in opening that country up to the work of people who may say things that the government finds untenable?
In from my view, the collecting community hasn't played a role at all in that. That the collecting community right now is very interested in artist investment.
Mm-hmm. Status symbol.
Yeah, artist investment. You know, it's a newly rich community. You have over 100 billionaires now, which is second only to the United States. So this new rich, and often these individuals have only acquired their wealth within the past 5 years.
Hmm.
So collecting has become part of the new asset class, and so they haven't really played a role at all.
My guests this hour are Melissa Chu, who is director of the Asia Society Museum in New York, and Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center. They'll be speaking tonight about China, Artists Behind the Wall. That talk takes place at 7 at the Nasher Sculpture Center. You can find more information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you would like to join our conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Jeremy Strick, director of the Nasher Sculpture Center, and Melissa Chu, director of the Asia Society Museum in New York. They'll be working together to deliver the lecture this evening at the Nasher Sculpture Center at 7, entitled China, Artists Behind the Wall. If you want to be part of our conversation, send email to think@KERA.org or call 1-800-933-5372. By the way, thank you to Jeff Whittington for confirming for us that Ai Weiwei currently, as of 5 minutes ago, had 103,904 Twitter followers. I want to ask you guys this. Have you met Ai Weiwei, and what are your impressions?
Well, I think Melissa spent much more time with him than I have. I've met him on a couple of occasions, and my experience, I mean, particularly the second encounter when I was with my young daughter, and he was so charming to her. Mm-hmm. It was really very sweet.
I met Ai Weiwei at the kind of late 1990s when I was doing a lot of research on the Chinese contemporary art scene. What I find curious is that he always has something strange something strange to do or to say, in that when I took a group of my museum patrons to visit his studio, he spent the whole time filming them with his video camera, which ended up in one of his video works. So he's kind of one of those real characters. He's, and you know, has had a very interesting life, and increasingly, I mean, I think his political activism has really led him to, his studio now has become something of a pilgrimage site. I think every collector in New York City who goes to Beijing wants to go to Ai Weiwei's studio. It's quite an odd thing. But, I think the status that he has acquired through now his international fame is quite something. I don't know any other artist in China who has had this kind of effect. Yeah.
He's been offered work at a university in Germany, and I guess there are questions as to whether he would be allowed to leave China. I'm curious about, if he were allowed to leave, would he be allowed to return?
That's right.
So you're curious about the same thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hi. I just wanted to break the conversation out a little bit and discuss maybe... all governments, including local governments in this country, use laws to stifle artistic speech. And there's a lot of stuff going on in New York right now about the group public coming together that people are doing and ways that they can stop these using laws, and lots of things about personality. And that's a lot about, you know, disadvantaged or groups of people who are speaking without the ability to put things up in large spaces, because that's all privately owned, and or we're using market forces to stifle speech. And I'll take my answer off. Yeah.
Thanks for your call. Is it reasonable to make that comparison to the ways that other governments stifle artistic expression?
That's one of the things that a number of Chinese artists often say, is that we talk about censorship in China. And it's funny, because whenever I give a lecture on Chinese contemporary art, one of the first questions from the audience is always about censorship in China. Mm-hmm. But often Chinese artists say to me, well, there's censorship everywhere. What are you talking about? So I think that it would be true to say that censorship exists, it just takes different forms. And it may indeed, sometimes in Western democracies, be more market related than government enforced.
I think that in the case of Ai Weiwei, here's someone who really crystallized his position vis-a-vis the Chinese government and the production of his own art and of his blog into a broad critique of the Chinese state. And I think that that prominence and that very broad positioning and his understanding and the understanding they promulgated of the nature of the Chinese state is something that's really important about his own practice, and really explains some of the response, which is, in this case, was significant.
Is there a particular reason why he is drawn to the cause of migrant laborers in China?
Migrant laborers have, and they were often referred to in China as the floating population, because here you have one of the world's largest migrations going on right now. It began in the late 1990s with the reconstruction of Beijing. And many artists lived with these migrant workers, but they came basically from the countryside to the city with no working papers. So they really are often people with no status and no claims to housing, nor healthcare, nor anything. In fact, there have been recent reports in China of NGOs, not so much NGOs actually, but people trying to set up schools for the children of migrant workers who have, and there's been a real effort to disband those schools. So there are lots of social issues around migrant workers that suggest that in the future this will be one of the major issues. In fact, I think in the around the time of the financial crisis, there was great concern on the part of the Chinese government to try and get those workers to return back to the villages because a lot of them were out of work and posed a threat to the stability of the city.
You know, it was once suggested to me that throughout Chinese history, what governments have always feared are peasant revolts, and what has toppled empires repeatedly have been peasant revolts. And China, with all of its great prosperity, increasing prosperity in recent years, there have also been rising inequality. And it's a concern of the Chinese government today. And I think one of the things that Ai Weiwei has done, his critique, yes, he talks about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, but focusing on things like migrant workers, focusing on the earthquakes, on the ways in which, on corruption, these are the big things in China that the government has to address and that I think they fear the repercussions of. So it's a very historically powerful critique.
I'm curious about how art and art theories and art history are taught in Chinese schools to children. Are they sort of given a very classical interpretation of what good art is, or are they exposed to more contemporary traditions?
You're referring to high school students?
High school, yeah. You know, students who wouldn't necessarily be on the university level but would have some art education.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the art teaching curriculum, but I would say that that in fact the understanding of arts and culture is one that is increasingly grounded in more of a traditional teaching, and by that I mean just in terms of cultural traditions and an appreciation of them, which is in direct contrast to what happened during the Cultural Revolution. So there's been a bit of a return to that. I think that the big social change has actually been that parents now see being a visual artist as actually a good career decision. So the traditional Chinese view of art as not a proper profession for their children to go into has completely changed because of the superstar status of many of the leading Chinese artists and kind of market darlings. So what we have now is an exponential growth in colleges and university education for artists. So places like the Central Academy of Arts in Beijing has increased something like three or fourfold in terms of its student intake. And there is a great sense within the Chinese government of wanting to encourage creative industries. And that's why when Jeremy referred to the 798 complex and all the young people, I mean, it's quite incredible, but it is filled with young people who want to be part of creative design or being an artist or anything. That is the big sea change that's happened in China.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. So besides perhaps getting a translated version of that Twitter feed and paying attention to what Ai Weiwei and some of his colleagues have to say, in what ways can we support Chinese artists from where we are in this country?
That's a really good question. Mm. I think that there are certainly some artists in China who have a desire to connect with the world and to tell the world through their work about the living circumstances of those in China. I think that there is also a growing interest on the part of museums here in the United States in showing that. And so I think one way would be to go and see the work when it is in a museum here in the United States, or follow the work on artists' websites. I mean, there are 420 million internet users in China, and so they are artists in China are more connected and more web savvy than anywhere else in the world. In fact, when you looked at the Charles Saatchi's websites where artists were able to download their own works, a large proportion of them were from China. So there is a great desire on the part of Chinese artists to connect with audiences outside of China, and you can do that through the web.
Yeah, and going to museums, going to exhibitions, the things that connect you to artists and I think connect us all.
Is there a lot of acknowledgement in contemporary Chinese art of the tension between and among and around the issue of the 56 ethnic groups that exist within China?
I don't see...
It's not a focus.
Yeah, I don't see a focus at all. In fact, quite the contrary in that I've seen a real interest in specifically in Tibet on the part of a number of artists. And it's not in terms of the politics around Tibet, but it's interest in the kind of cultural difference. And more artists are visiting Tibet because of the ease with which the train between Beijing and Lhasa has allowed. So, I mean, I think that there's interest culturally, but none from what I see in terms of the politics of those ethnic groups.
Who else might we look for in terms of really understanding and getting a handle on Chinese art today besides Ai Weiwei? Are there other names that you can give us that we would want to explore?
There are, in fact, a growing number of publications on this topic. When I first began my research in the 1990s, I actually did my PhD research on artists who had left China. Ai Weiwei was one of a great exodus of artists who left China in the 80s and 90s. And my professor said to me that I was absolutely crazy because there are only two books in the world published on that subject. Now, however, it's completely different. And you can actually find out a lot. Just online, but also through published books. The Museum of Modern Art just published a very important document, which are primary documents, artist manifestos, artist statements from all of the period that we've discussed. So I would look towards some of the books and research that have been done and are in circulation as a great foundation. Yeah.
I would also actually just plug an exhibition that Melissa and the Asia Society are sending to our neighbors across the street, the Crow Collection of a marvelous contemporary Chinese artist, Qian Xiong, that opens next month. So there are opportunities here in Dallas to see some of the work of the best artists working today.
Yeah. I read an interesting analysis that Chinese documentary filmmakers are doing very interesting work, and they're able to get the work made. It's a question of whether or not they can get it distributed there domestically. Have you seen a particular trend in the kinds of films that are coming out of China lately?
You know, one of the biggest stars in terms of that trend is Chen Kaige was actually the reason why he's on my mind is that he was one of the artists who was in Ai Weiwei's exhibition that we had at Asia Society, and he's kind of a huge star. But one of the trends, I think, towards a kind of real realism that shows the underbelly of the great dream of China as one of posterity and all of that. And those filmmakers have received a lot of attention outside of China. And so I think that with that, it's always about distribution. And I think in China, the distribution is held so tightly by the government. And there is a real priority on the big-name state-run projects. So that's really a concern.
Melissa Chu is director of the Asia Society Museum in New York. Jeremy Strick is director of the Nasher Sculpture Center. Their joint TEDxSMU and Nasher-sponsored lecture takes place tonight at 7 at the Nasher. It's called China, Artists Behind the Wall. Melissa and Jeremy, it's been great to have you both with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.